Well, good morning, everyone. I'm wearing Aisho's glasses, which should be an interesting starting point for us. It's interesting enough seeing all of you out there with my ordinary eyes, and then, you know, her eyes, her glasses don't quite go, you know, into the distance. So it's a little blurry for the people at that end of the hall. So anyway, I'd like to continue looking at our Ango study text for the summer. Dogen's Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. Each of our speakers this summer has taken one aspect or another of the fascicle. Yesterday, Aisho remarked on the fact that all four of the methods of guidance were based on the experience of being one with all that is, as was reflected in the fascicle Ika Myoju, One Bright Pearl. What has been remarkable to me, however, is that the writing in the Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance is very different from what I'm accustomed to reading in Dogen. Perhaps my reaction is different from others, but when I first started reading the four methods, I felt kind of bored and disappointed. Take the opening lines, for example. The Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. Giving means non-greed. Non-greed means not to covet. Not to covet means not to curry favor. Even if you govern the four continents, you should always convey the authentic path with non-greed. It is like giving away unneeded belongings to someone you don't know, to offer flowers blooming on a distant mountain to the Tathagata, or again to offer treasures you had in your former life to sentient beings. Well, for the beginning of a Dharma talk, that's not bad. Most of us would be quite happy to have written those words. But, listen to this. The entire universe is one bright pearl. What is there to interpret or to understand? One bright pearl expresses reality without naming it. It is the name of the universe. It contains the inexhaustible past, existing throughout time and arriving in the present. Presently there is a body and mind. They are the one bright pearl. A stalk of grass, a tree, the mountains and rivers of the world are not only themselves, they are the bright pearl. We can never escape from the universe, which is nothing but one bright pearl. Even if it seemed to you that you have escaped it for a little while, you are still in time, and all time is covered by one bright pearl. When the right time comes, the essence of the bright pearl can be grasped. It is suspended in emptiness, hidden in the lining of clothes, found under the chin of dragons and in the headdresses of kings. The pearl is always inside our clothing, that is, inside of us, our real nature. That too is Dogen. And that's poetry. Scintillating brilliance that draws us into the mystery that goes beyond words. That's why I love Dogen so much. But it's more than mere poetry. It's an engaging of and a going beyond dualism. You know, in dualism, in Buddhism, dualism is considered the major fault of human existence, and our tendency to be dualistic is seen as the cause of all of our suffering. So it seems to me that in the four methods of guidance, we're basically given one side, the good side. We're given the side of giving. Not too much talk about non-giving. Not too much talk about stinginess. We're given the side of kind speech, but not much about critical, destructive, or hateful speech. We're given the side of beneficial action, not so much about deadly, destructive action. We're given the side of identity action, not the side of the value of separateness and self-elevation. So, if we are to use the four methods of guidance for would-be bodhisattvas, we need to have a way of engaging the negative dimension of our own lives and finding a way through to realize our own true Buddha nature. In other words, how do we get there from here? As we all know, it doesn't work simply to tell people to be generous or to tell ourselves to be kind or to do good deeds and show compassion. We can all do that on our best days. It's the other days that's the problem. So I think there are two problems, at least, for people to be as loving and caring as they would like to be. One is what Dogen calls the belief of foolish people. People who think that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost. Most of the world operates according to this principle. Most people believe that there's a fixed amount of goods to go around in the world, so if they give some of what they have, then they have lost whatever that amount may be, whether it's money or compassion. The second factor I'm reminded of is from Sidney Poitier in The Heat of the Night. Those of you who are old enough may remember. You may recall Poitier comes as a federal agent to this southern town to investigate some wrongdoings. He is met by the sheriff's department and is mishandled, arrested, and abused. He keeps insisting that Carol O'Connor, the sheriff, confirm that he is a federal agent. And when O'Connor finally does, O'Connor tells Poitier that Poitier's problem is he doesn't show proper respect to authorities. "Don't you know what respect is, boy?" O'Connor says. Poitier says, "Yes, it's what you don't get unless you give." That's the point, right? You can't get it unless you give it. And that's sort of true of what Dogen is talking about. How can we give kind speech if we have not received kind speech? How can we give if we have not been given to? How can we engage in beneficial action if we don't know what that is? And how can we engage in identity action if we're completely trained to see ourselves as separate? So, I have another story to bring into the discussion. I had the great experience this summer of teaching a course on family systems at New York Theological Seminary. I've already talked about this with several of you. Family systems, if you're not familiar with it, takes a look at how every family is a system, and not only the immediate family of parents and children, but also the preceding generations. And so the theory of family systems is that if you take a good look at a number of the generations in your family and go back as far as you can and get enough information, you're going to learn that certain things, certain patterns repeat themselves generation after generation. Or they may skip a generation and then pop up again. And so this holds true evidently on a genetic basis as well as on a behavioral basis. And so we find certain families, for example, diabetes may be prone to diabetes. And you may find that in certain families where there's been a suicide, there were one generation or two generations before a suicide before that one. And there are other behaviors that continue to repeat themselves. So it's a very, very interesting and very valuable exercise to look very carefully at our family histories and look at all of the characters, especially look for the ones that don't usually get included in family conversation. For example, my grandmother on my father's side had a brother who was hospitalized in a psychiatric hospital, and so that means this is years ago, you know, not quite 100 years ago, but a long time ago, before psychiatric hospitals had psychotropic medication. And so it was such a horror for the family that basically my grandmother never mentioned him at all. I heard about him from my mother. And so there was this family secret. And as we explore family systems, we find secrets tend to repeat, and they become the basis for a lack of communication in a family, and they also become the basis for the transmission of a sense of shame and usually a kind of protective barrier that the family puts around itself in relation to the rest of the world. So we try to protect ourselves, we maintain our secrets so that we can have a persona that's acceptable to the world, and we're doing just fine with that. And that means if you're a child and you have some kind of inclination to do something that's not acceptable in the family system, you're going to be in trouble. And that's usually what happens. So anyway, understanding family systems is a very, very valuable tool for us to understand ourselves. One of the things that it does is when we see our own struggles having been foreshadowed by a generation or two before ourselves, then we learn a little bit of more of compassion for ourselves. Oh, I'm not the only one. Oh, I'm not the only one that thought I was stupid, or, you know, I'm not the only one that was embarrassed because I did get good grades. That sort of thing. So basically, in this course, we were exploring not only people's history, but what's in their minds and in their hearts. Because the mind actually doesn't forget. It may suppress memories, but it knows a lot more than we consciously think about. So the suffering and pain and the cruelty of a culture that has been so oppressed by slavery produced families that were torn apart, fathers who had been castrated, women who had been raped. So as we began to explore the family systems, this particular class happened to be mostly African American. So most of them were descendants of slaves. And we began to see in a way that it brought tears to my eyes, that the way in which, you know, the family had been dismembered, you know, in terms of the family unit, as well as, you know, physically in many cases. And the result was people having to live without a family, or having to construct a family out of whoever was, you know, available. And now, post-slavery, they are still having to deal with the same issues. This does not usually reach our textbooks. You know, it's not usually what we talk about history. But this is why the television series Roots, from, 30, 40 years ago now, was so important. And we could tell in the class how many people had names that were given after the discovery of Roots, You know, after, in other words, African Americans begin to realize their identity began in Africa. And so they began to give each other African names rather than, you know, the white man's names. And it was a very significant shift within the African American community. But still, you've got all of that history to deal with. The result of simply opening up the conversation to so much pain allowed the students to see themselves as they never had before, to see themselves as a multi-generational history of people who suffered and struggled, and yet with a damaged core continuing to be lived out in desperation and hopelessness, and bringing all of that awareness into the class was really fantastic. And, you know, it's the sort of thing that, frankly, most white people would have trouble doing. But in that sense, they were more accepting of their own past than we might have been. It was a transformation event. So it's extremely valuable. And how does that relate to Dogen? Well, it means that if we are to have kind speech, if we are even to know what it is, we have to deal with what's contrary to that. If we're to do beneficial action, we have to deal with the other kinds of actions that may be feeling instinctual to us, you know, to react to any kind of criticism or challenge or threat physically. So we have to look at both sides of our own history, both sides of our own lives. If we're to use these four methods of guidance for would-be bodhisattvas, we need to have a way of engaging the negative dimensions of our own lives and finding a way through to realize our Buddha nature. On another occasion recently, I interviewed a couple who were in serious conflict and contemplating divorce. Neither one of them would listen to the other without interrupting and countering what each thought the other was going to say before they ever said it. Amazing kind of conversation, you know, and like I was wondering how these sentences were going to end, but I never found out. I wondered why they did this, since, you know, it was so clearly doomed to frustration and resulted in reinforcing each one's sense of victimization. They had been over their issues so many times they could practically say each other's lines. The issues never got above the level of complaint and accusation. That was the name of the game. Needless to say, if I had let it go on, the volume would have escalated, and the antagonism and hurt, attack and counterattack would have continued. I asked them how well this seemed to be working in solving their problems. And of course, each answered by blaming the other one for not understanding themselves. Finally, I said, "It looks like both of you believe that there's not enough to go around." And they say, yeah, that's right. Not enough money, not enough time, not enough caring, not enough consideration. Both of them jumped in with a yes, that's exactly right. And that's why I have to get my say in first, they each said. Or else she or he will think that he or she is right. I saw the same thing happen a few days ago when a man from my church died. He came home late from driving a cab. Everyone else was asleep. He went to sleep on the couch with the TV on. A few hours later, his wife came downstairs and tried to wake him up to get him to go to bed, but she could not wake him up. He was 42. There was a long history of keeping jobs only short term, many financial problems. When I met with the wife and their three children, who were aged 13, 11, and 8, they were, of course, distraught. And as I asked them to tell me about what happened, all four of them, not just the children, all four of them scrambled to tell me their point of view, as if they had to shout the loudest in order to be heard. It's the same kind of phenomenon. So often they would be challenging and denying what each other said to lift up their own version as being the correct one. And I sensed in this this pattern also a desperation, because one of the things that the way they were arguing about was how long really was Dad alive, and when did he really die, and who saw him first, and what was the last thing you said to him, and did he say goodbye to you? And of course, he didn't say goodbye to anybody. So they sat there on the couch as we were talking, you know, and they're all in tears and out of tears, and the smallest one, the mother said, he had a question for you. He has a question about God. And I said, oh, what's that? He said, why did God take my dad? And I said, well, I don't believe God took your dad. You know, the reason your dad died, we don't really know yet. There's been no autopsy at that point. But I believe he's with God, but it's not because God wanted to take him away from you, because God knows you need him. And God will try to take care of you. And then conversation went on a bit further, and another one said, because they started talking about heaven and, you know, explaining everything. Well, Dad's in heaven now. He's not suffering. He's okay now. He's at peace. And then one comes up, well, how do we know he's going to heaven? Don't you just love it? What if he's going to the bad place? And I said, I don't believe in such a bad place. I think that I think God calls us all to the good place. And they seemed very happy to hear that. I think, you know, one of the problems is adults who haven't been to, you know, church since Sunday school days, and they have this theology that they make up about God and heaven and hell and all of that stuff, and they use it to explain what they don't know how to explain, but it doesn't really help. It, you know, it winds up making you worry, well, is Dad actually going to hell now? Because they all knew, you know, Dad had his faults. So, you know, I think the most important thing about that particular meeting was I gave them time for everybody to speak and to say whatever, you know, whatever they needed to say, and to voice the questions. You know, people have ideas about life and death and what it means, you know, to lose your own father. My point here is about kind speech. And the point is that listening precedes speech. being listened to precedes speech. If we aren't listened to, we spend our lives trying to get through to unknown people that are outside our skin and feeling very frustrated because we have had the experience that no matter what words we use doesn't help. But to be able to be listened to, I think, is crucial. And on some level, all of us here have had that experience. It may not have been enough, you know, or may not have been completely exactly right, but we wouldn't have enough capacity for compassion for ourselves to be here if we hadn't been listened to some degree in our lives. So, I have no doubt that when Dogen was reading the Tripitaka, that his mother was listening to him when he was 3 years old. I have no doubt about that. Otherwise, he would never have gotten through it. So we need that. And that helps make things better. Now, especially with my little hint from in the heat of the night, it should be no big stretch to see how this same dynamic applies to the recent events in Ferguson, Missouri. Who was listened to? Who was not? Who issued kind speech? Who did not? You know, I feel a personal connection actually with that part of the country. It's part of the Cotton Belt and Bible Belt that I grew up in, next door in Illinois. And what that means is, if those of you history buffs remember the Missouri Compromise of 1852. Missouri basically was declared a slave state, and that thereafter, states that are above that latitude would be considered free states. So Missouri was sort of the last holdout for being a slave state. So that's part of the history. And our whole country is responsible for that. So before we go running off, you know, shouting about rednecks, who obviously is not us, we should pay attention to the history that we caused. And that's one of the liberating aspects of being a Buddhist, is we take responsibility for all of history. The Missouri Compromise made Missouri a slave state. The Emancipation Proclamation could be considered kind speech. The words of the sheriff, the words of the highway patrol, the words of newspapers and television people, all words have an impact and contribute to what evolves as the history of our nation. So how do we turn things around? Within ourselves, that's a big enough challenge. But within our nation and our world, are they separate? How can we move from whatever pain and challenges we have experienced to envision a different world? To see the Buddha world in which there is enough. To be present to one another in a way that allows space to be heard. To see the Buddha world in which each of us can discover our own Buddha nature by its being discovered by another. I don't know about you, but, you know, in Jukai ceremony, when we do that, you know, Buddha meets Buddha. That's cool. How can we learn and grow in the Buddha way, and how can we find words that bring healing to a wounded, conflict-ridden world? Kind speech, beneficial action, identity action. Here we are. We are it. This is how it's done. The path of precepts and all of the paths that we're doing, study, reflection, this is the work. This is what makes our zazen possible. If we didn't have some compassionate place to feel like we were being heard in our own particular juicy little stuff, we would not be able to sit as long as we do on the cushion. And so we're able to go through our own process, however slowly, of course, all too slowly, but just the right time of transformation.